subjects with which we are dealing may not be merely intellectual, but grant that we may realize that we are dealing with thy judgment upon the whole world and thy judgment upon us. And do thou grant that we may realize the gravity of that condemnation that has passed upon all, and of that death with which all are inflicted, because we all sinned in Adam. O Lord, forbid that we should take lightly thy judgment, and that thus we may be prepared for that real heart abiding appreciation of the justification that is in Christ Jesus through his righteousness as the righteousness of the spotless Lamb of God. For his name's sake, amen.
Now I have been dealing with this great mystery of the sins which are due death that have to came out of them. And I have come to the third criticism, namely that this Pelagian Jesus is in direct contradiction of the repeated affirmations of this passage. And at the close of the hour I have come to this point, that if Paul says that the reign of condemnation and death proceeds from the one sin of the one man Adam, then it is impossible at the same time to say that men shall come into condemnation and die because of their own natural transgression. And that is precisely what Paul says in this passage in verses 15 through 17, then through 19. You have that principle repeatedly asserted. By the trespass of the one, the many died. Verse 15. The judgment was from one to condemnation. Verse 16. By the trespass of the one, death reigned through the one. By the trespass of the one, death reigned through the one. Verse 17. Through one trespass, judgment came upon all men unto condemnation. Then, at verse 18, and then through the disobedience of the one man, the many were constituted to death. Now do pay attention to these repeated affirmations, stated in different ways, but all leading to this all-important proposition that death and condemnation came to reign over all men, over the whole human race, by the one sin, one man, Adam. You might think that the Apostle Paul had quite needlessly repeated himself. He was guilty of redundancy. But it is just because the apostle was so jealous to establish that theme of the significance for the whole human race of the one sin, of the one man, that he reiterated that principle in different form so that it would be absolutely watertight and that the conclusion would be absolutely inescapable. And it is quite impossible to construe this reiterated emphasis upon the one sin of the one man, Adam, as equivalent to the actual personal sins of all men. Impossible as the actual personal sins of all men. God, may I say again, I mentioned yesterday, that the whole emphasis here is upon singularity. But when you are thinking of the personal transgressions of all men, you have in mind plural, uncountable plural. Now for this Pelagian construction is not compatible with the whole structure of this passage. It's not compatible with the governing principle of this whole passage, the structure, the central strand in this is the parallelism between the entrance of sin, condemnation, and death, and the entrance of righteousness, justification, and life, the parallelism between the way in which sin, condemnation, and death came to reign, and the way that righteousness, justification, and life come to be operated. And in view of that parallelism, there must be an identity of motive of the enemy. Latin phrase means mode of operation. There must be an identity more than the other one. The analogy couldn't okay. The parallelism couldn't so what is that? The parallel. In reference to righteousness, justification, and life. What is that kind of balance? What is this that we are justified by the righteousness one man, Jesus Christ, and nothing could be more obvious. Justified by the righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. And all is so insistent upon establishing the parallelism here that he calls the righteousness of Jesus Christ
the one right his act. Verse 18. The one right his act, the one righteousness. Then in verse 19 he calls it the obedience of the one. So undoubtedly, it is the one righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. But what all of this controversy, this part of the epistle, verse 5 chapters of the epistle of Romans, what he is controverting is the doctrine that we are justified by our own works. That's the doctrine he's controverting. Now, that is what is true on the other side of the parallel. What is it that provides the parallel in the case of Adam and Pushdown? What is it that provides it? Is it the actual sins of all men as the ground of condemnation? If it were the actual sins of all men, then that would be parallel to the very doctrine that the Apostle Paul is refuting. Parallel to the very doctrine he's refuting, namely, that men are justified by their own works. And so the only Jesus that can provide the parallel to justification, to life, is the one sin of the one man Adam, as the mound of the condemnation of death that is cast upon all men. That is the only power that can provide the analogy is the one sin of the one man that is the ground of condemnation of death. So you see, you have factual, exegetical, and theological considerations militating against the Pelagian exegesis. Therefore, militating against the exegesis, which is perhaps most current in Protestant circles today, because it is the identity theology. Well, Romans, for example, the refutation of the Pelagian view. Now, we come to the next interpretation of the passage. The last clause in verse 12, that we passage came up on. And this is the Roman passage. Now there appears to be admitted that there was not unanimity in the history of the Roman Catholic Church on this question. There were two very notable Roman Catholic theologians at the time of the Reformation, at the time of the Council of Trent, who maintained the position that I think is the correct position. They were Catharinus and Pigius, C-A-T-H-E-R-N-U-S,
and D-I-G-H-I-U-S, Catalinus and Figius. But nevertheless, the contentions of Catalinus and Figius did not win the day in the Roman Catholic Church. And although there is a good deal of obscurity on in the Roman Catholic disputation on this question, into which I am not going to enter now, nevertheless, the classic Roman Catholic position, the preponderant Roman Catholic position, is that the pater immortal in Romans 5:12b, the pater immortal refers to habitual or original sin, which is transmitted to Adam. By natural generation, habitual original sin transmitted to Adam's posterity by natural generation. Accident, according to the Roman Catholic construction, consists namely in the privation of sanctity. The privation of sanctity. Now the Roman Catholic Church recognizes the relationship which that habitual sin sustains to the first sin of Adam. The Roman Catholic Church is quite clear on that point, that this privation of sanctity arises from the sin of Adam, Adam's prevarication, as it is called, in eating the forbidden fruit. But nevertheless, the sin that is passed on to posterity is the habitual sin, resulting from Adam's prevarication. Now this truth will not hold up either. There are exegetes and theological objections to this Roman Catholic view also. The first I mentioned is simply a presumptive argument which I don't regard as demonstrably conclusive, but presumptive, and I might call it a grammatical argument. The presumptive argument is that it is very difficult to reconcile this interpretation with the use of the historical years came up. Because this use refers to a certain condition which is perpetually
been passed on from Adam to the whole human race by ordinary generation. And although it is not absolutely impossible, but absolutely impossible to think of the earliest sense to that connection, nevertheless, it would be quite abnormal. And what you would expect here is the perfect. Rather than the aorist, if that is exactly what Paul had in mind. Not that all sin, but that all have come to be sinful, and the perfect sin would be perfectly to express that idea of how come to be sinful, because it would denote a present condition resultant upon a past action. And the perfect is admirably said that the ears tense would not be the most appropriate. However, there might be a way which I don't want to discuss now. There might be a way for the ideas or just call it a theory. But it is not something that is to be completely overlooked. Now the second argument against this Roman Catholic view is that it is quite contrary to the parallelism which is instituted in this passage. My contribution to the passage is the central strand again of this passage is the analogy between Adam and Christ. Now, what is Paul's doctrine? With reference to justification. It is not that we are justified by having righteousness infused into us. We are not justified by being made subjectively holy through our relationship to Christ. We are justified by his once for all completed obedience, by his once for all accomplished righteousness. Now, of course, the Roman Catholic Church is not inconsistent at this point. Because the Roman Catholic Church does believe that justification consists in regeneration and renovation. And so on the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification, the parallel would hold. The parallel between Adam and Christ would hold. But the point now is that the woman every doctrine of justification is not false.
There is one syllable in this
there isn't one syllable in this text suggesting the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification. Everything in this passage points to our justification by the one righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. Justification by the one righteousness or obedience of the one man, Jesus Christ. And therefore, again, and in connection with the Canadian exegesis, the only parallel, to that is that we have become condemned. That we are condemned and the heirs of death by the one sin of the one man Adam. Now the third argument in refutation. The third argument in refutation is again the sustained emphasis of the passage in verses 15 through 19. The sustained emphasis of the passage. That condemnation has passed upon all, and that death comes to reign over all by the one sin of the one man. 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. By the precept of the one, the men died. The judgment was from one unto condemnation. By the disobedience of the one, the men were constituted. Remember the five distinct instances which that very same principle is asserted.
The disobedience of the one, the men were constituted. Remember the five distinct instances which that very same principle is asserted, and asserted in different forms in order to exclude all possibilities of defeat on the conclusion that it was by the one sin of the one man added that condemnation came fast upon all men, and that death came to exercise its sway upon them. Now, original sin transmission can never be called the one sin of the one man. Truly, that is true. Having that is all needed involved in himself in habitual sin, he became sinful, he became slave. That then his sanity transmitted to posterity can never be called the one sin, one man.
And so you see in the Roman Catholic interpretation,
we come to Calvin's interpretation, and Calvin's own interpretation.
exegetically speaking, Calvin's interpretation is identical with the Roman Catholic. Exegetically.
His view of original sin is radically different.
Rome construed original sin, habitual sin, as consisting very largely in the privation of sanctity. Calvin regarded original sin as radical depravity. Radical depravity. As consisting not simply in the loss of original righteousness, but the corruption of man's whole nature. I repeat, consisting not simply in the loss of original righteousness, but the corruption of his whole nature. You must remember that a great deal of the polemic of the reformers on this question directed against the Roman Catholic view of original sin, habitual sin. The polemic of the Reformation, especially of Calvin and the Reformers, is to a very large extent focused on the refutation of the Roman Catholic doctrine. But nevertheless, exegetically speaking, Calvin's own interpretation of Romans 5:12b, et o pantisci martum, is in the same category as the Romanist interpretation, because he takes it as referring to original sin, to hereditary depravity. What he calls hereditary depravity. That in Adam all became sinful. And you'll find that in his commentary, of course, and you'll find it also in the Institute. You'll find it quite clearly stated in his commentary on Romans, but Paul distinctly affirms that sin is propagated to all who suffer its punishment. And this he afterwards more expressly declares when a little later he assigns the reason why all of Adam's posterity are subject to the dominion of death. Even this, he says, being that we all have sinned, but the sin is in this case to be corrupt and vicious. He just quoted Romans 5:12b, and that all sin, inasmuch as all sin, corneum omnes peccavimus, but to sin is in this case to be corrupt and vitiated. For that natural depravity which we bring from our mother's womb, though it does not immediately bring forth its fruit, is nevertheless sin in the sight of God and deserves his vengeance. And this is the sin which they call original. For so Adam at his first creation received both for himself and for posterity the gifts of divine favor, so by falling away from the Lord, he in himself corrupted, vitiated, depraved, and ruined our nature. Having been divested of God's likeness, he could not have begotten seed but like himself. Therefore we all have sinned, because we have all been imbued with natural corruption, and so are become wicked and perverse. Now there's a total difference between Calvin's conception of this perversity that we all derive from Adam
and the Roman Catholic confession a bit like them, but you see, it is in the same category as it is. Now, this had been an Augustinian tradition. An Augustinian tradition. The Roman Catholic Church followed that Augustinian tradition, but of course watered down the Augustinian conception of original sin. Calvin did not water down the Augustinian conception of original sin, but he did not get above or beyond the Augustinian tradition in the interpretation of this particular passage. And so the same argument must be pleaded against Calvin's own interpretation of this passage, and pleaded against the Holy Testament. I don't need to repeat these, but they all apply. I would not urge the first presumptive argument with the same vigor or with the same term against Calvin's view as I would a Roman Catholic, because the way he puts it, he might possibly reconcile it with Beale's tent. This is his own statement. By falling away from the Lord, that is Adam, by falling away from the Lord, he in himself corrupted, vitiated, depraved, and ruined our nature. It's possible that Beale's tent could be used to explain that fact. He's looking upon as a lot more dissipated human nature. Once for all, he has dissipated and corrupted human nature. And that might be quite compatible with the use of the air of sin. Now, for we come to the classic Protestant view of Romans 5:12, the classic Protestant view. You see, we are still concerned with this clause in Romans 5:12, in that all sense. What does Paul mean? Now it is quite clear in verse 12, quite clear, that the universal reign of death rests upon the fact that all sin have to escape. No one disputes that. Couldn't be. And so death penetrated to all men in that all sins are on the ground of the fact of all sin. That's quite clear. And whatever may be contemplated in that passage, Hamartor, heaven may be, it is the reason why death passed into all men. But in verses 15 through 19, all the creation and more people. That the universal reign of death rests upon the one trespass of the one man Adam. And so you have two indisputable statements.
The universal reign of death rests upon the fact that
all ends as it ever was. Likewise, that the universal reign of death rests upon the one purpose of the one man Adam. What are we going to do with that? Are we to suppose that Paul was dealing with two entirely different situations? And that in verse 12 is dealing with one situation? The explanation of which is simply that all things, whereas in verses 15 through 19, he is dealing with an entirely different situation. But the explanation is the one sin that the one man has. Now, unless you are going to identify these two, unless you are going to identify the situation in verse 12, and the situation in verses 15 through 19 with which Paul is dealing, that is what you are bound to do. And you're dealing with different situations. Dealing with an entirely different truth concept. How is that possible? Is it possible for us? All that two entirely different situations of view in these two times. One in verse 12 and another in verse 15. Is it possible? And that's the question I'm going to discuss right now. And I'm going to suggest that we discuss why we must hold Lord's form of 1, 2, and 3. I'm going to suggest the reason why we must hold that all is being with the same situation. The same truth comes. The same things of God's judgment. And the first reason is this. What they call passage is a unit. Lord, please, form of one. They call passage is a unit. As I said repeatedly, the central strand is the
the remaining part of the lecture was not recorded, so I shall play it into the tape myself from my notes. The last part of the lecture was Mr. gave three reasons why we should hold to that position that says Paul is dealing with the same situation, the same truth complex, the same phase of God's government. Mr. Murray gave the first reason, that the whole passage is a unit. And he said that, repeatedly, he had said that the central strand is parallelism. The central strand is the identity of the modus operandi. It is quite impossible to suppose that in verse 12, Paul is dealing with one phase of God's government, and in verses 15 through 17, he is dealing with another. He emphasizes the closely knit unit of the whole passage. The second reason is that not only is this passage a closely knit unit, But we must remember that in verse 12, that verse 12 is an unfinished comparison. If verse 12 were completed in the context of its own terms, and if it were possible to think that there is a radical transition at the end of verse 12, or for that matter, at the end of verse 14, then it would be possible for us to think Paul is dealing with two distinct phases of God's government. This is, however, not possible, for we only know what the hypothesis of 12 would be if it were completed in its own terms from the hypothesis which we find in verses 15 through 19. In other words, Paul doesn't complete the comparison in verse 12 because he relies on the succeeding verses to supply the hypothesis which verse 12 would have required if completed. And the third reason is that Paul is dealing with the same phase of God's government. Verse 14 makes it impossible to interpret verse 12b, Pontus Hamartan, in any other terms than that which is unfolded later in verses 15 through 19. For verse 14 tells us that death reigned over those who did not sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. The reign of death in verse 14 is the same reign referred to in verse 12 when Paul says death penetrated or passed through to all men. So in verse 14, Paul is saying death passed on to and reigned over certain persons who did not voluntarily transgress as Adam did. The only reasonable inference is that the sin of Adam had implications for those whom death reigned over.